The Process of Decision. 1. Jamie was in Galveston when the long-awaited, long-feared final decision was unmade. Ever since he had joined the Mars Project, Houston had been as much of a home as he could claim. Although he had spent months on end in training sites all across the globe, nearly half a year in Antarctica, week after week in Florida, and even weeks aboard space stations orbiting the Earth, always he returned to Houston and Edith. Edie Elgin was the co-anchor of the 7 and 11 o'clock news at KHTV in Houston. She had interviewed Jamie when he had first arrived at the Johnson Space Center. A dinner invitation turned into a relationship that both of them knew was temporary, at best. "I'm not even thinking about marriage," Edith often told him. "Not until I get to New York and a job with one of the networks, maybe not even then." "I don't know where I'll be a year from now," Jamie said to her regularly. "If I don't make the Mars team, I'll probably head back to California for a teaching job." "No commitments," she would say. "Couldn't make any even if we wanted to," he would reply. Yet, whenever he returned to Houston, he returned to her. And although she never spoke of how she spent the time while he was away, she seemed always glad to see Jamie. They made a strange couple, the dark, taciturn, stocky half-Navajo, and the blonde, vivacious, ever-smiling TV anchorwoman. She was recognized wherever they went, of course, and although she was known as Edie to everyone who watched television, to Jamie she was always Edith. She claimed to be a natural blonde and 100% Texan, a cheerleader in high school, a beauty pageant queen at Texas A&M, where she had studied electronic journalism. She could not spell very well, but she could smile with perfect teeth, even while announcing a disastrous earthquake or an airliner crash. There was a crafty brain behind the pretty smile. She knew opportunity when it arrived, and she was wise enough never to let down her guard in the company of anyone even remotely connected with the news industry. With Jamie, though, she could be serious and tell him about her plans for her career. He could relax with her and forget about training and Mars and the men who stood between him and the assignment he cherished. Jamie had just returned from 3 weeks aboard the Mir 5 space station, working with Father DiNardo on the rock samples returned from Mars by the unmanned ships that had been landed on the Red Planet. He had thought that DiNardo had been given the power to make the final decision as to who would back him up on the Mars mission. The Jesuit disabused him of that notion just before he had to board the shuttle that would return him to Florida. DiNardo had asked him to come to the geology lab before he boarded the shuttle. The priest was waiting for him there, looking solemn, hanging weightlessly a few inches above the metal grillwork of the laboratory floor, his face so puffed up from the fluid shift that happens in near-zero gravity that he looked more like an Indian than Jamie himself. DiNardo shaved his balding scalp completely, yet there was a dark stubble across his jutting chin.
"The Board of Selection has made its decision," DiNardo said softly, the faintest hint of Italian vowels at the end of each word.
From the tone of the man's voice, Jamie knew the news was bad. The two of them were alone in the space station's geology lab, hovering weightlessly in the ape-like, half-crouching position the human body normally assumes in microgravity. A carefully sealed, glass-walled cabinet behind DiNardo held row upon row of reddish soil samples and small pink rocks from the surface of Mars. Jamie felt his stomach sinking.
"I am afraid," DiNardo went on gently, "that the choice has gone to Professor Hoffman."
Jamie heard himself ask, "And you concur?" His voice sounded harsh, tense, like a bowstring about to snap.
"I will not oppose the decision," DiNardo made a sad little smile. "Personally, I would rather have you travel with me. I think we would get along much better. But the selection board must consider politics and many other factors. For what it is worth, the decision was the most difficult choice they had to make.
And it's final."
"I am afraid that it is. Professor Hoffman will be the number two geologist on the mission. He will remain in the spacecraft in orbit about Mars, and I will go down to the surface."
"Fuck the two of you," Jamie wanted to say. Instead, he merely nodded, lips clamped together so hard that an hour later he could still feel the imprint of his teeth on them. From Cape Canaveral, Jamie had flown immediately to Houston, and from there, he and Edith had driven to Galveston in her new, sleek, dark green Jaguar. In her form-hugging jeans, tightly cuffed silk blouse, and racing-style sunglasses, she looked like a movie star, especially with her blonde hair blowing in the breeze. "It's a Ford Jaguar!" she shouted over the rushing wind and the growl of traffic, trying to cheer his dark mood.
"Got a Mercury 6 and transmission under the hood. Looks like a Jag, but I don't need an English mechanic riding in the back seat all the time."
As they roared along Interstate 45, Jamie said barely a word. The Friday afternoon traffic was heavy, but Edith weaved through the trucks and the other weekenders as if the highway patrol would never even try to stop her. Jamie knew that this was the last weekend he and Edith would spend together. On Monday, he would start packing his things. He wanted to be away from Houston, away from the Space Center, away from everything connected with the Mars mission, as far away as possible. Where? Back to the university at Albuquerque? Back to teaching geology to students who would spend their lives searching for oil? Back to spending summers picking at ancient meteor craters while others were exploring Mars? Back to Berkeley and his parents? Their hotel room in Galveston was high up in one of the towers that overlooked the Gulf of Mexico.
"It's a beautiful view, isn't it?"
Edith said, reaching one arm around Jamie's waist as they stood together by the sliding glass doors that opened onto a narrow patio. She nestled her head against his shoulder.
"Until the next hurricane," Jamie said.
"Yeah, we cover the storm damage every year, and every year they build more of these high-rises."
Jamie turned back to the bed and began to pull the shaving kit from his dark blue nylon travel bag.
"Which side of the closet do you want?" Edith asked.
"Doesn't matter." "You're really down, huh?"
"Down for the count," Jamie said, taking the kit to the bathroom and placing it on the shelf above the sink without bothering to open it up. She was at the doorway, more serious than he had ever known her to be.
"We got a release from the Mars Program Office that they'll announce the departure date Monday morning at a press conference in Geneva."
Jamie nodded.
"And the crew list?"
"You won't be going."
"I won't be going to Mars," he said.
Edith forced a shaky smile.
"Well, you've been saying all along that you didn't think they'd pick you.
Now I know for certain."
The smile faded.
"Now we both know."
"They'll go to Mars without me, and I'll disappear into oblivion," he said to himself, unable to speak the words aloud. "I'll become just another university geologist, going nowhere, accomplishing nothing." He looked at his face in the mirror over the sink. Anger smoldered in his dark eyes. "All you need is some war paint," he said to the somber image. Edith knew him well enough to realize he had no more words for her. She turned and went back to the sliding patio doors, tugged one open. It stuck halfway along its track.
"Damned rust," she muttered, slipping through the narrow opening and out onto the patio. "Air's pure salt out here."
Jamie crossed the carpeted room and leaned against the reluctant door, then pushed with all his strength with both hands, suddenly furious. It screeched and popped off its track as it slid all the way back. Jamie snorted and glared at it, hanging lopsided from its top rollers. Then he stepped through onto the patio. Going out of the air-conditioned room was like going from ice cream to hot soup. He felt perspiration instantly dampening his armpits. Edith ignored his explosion of brute force.
"Looks pretty," she said, gazing out at the tranquil gulf. "Between hurricanes, that is."
Grasping the railing beside her with both hands, Jamie tried to force his mind away from the pain and anger.
"Ever seen the Pacific?"
"Just on tapes."
"The surf is incredible. This is a milk pond by comparison."
"You ever surf?"
"Not really," he said. "Never had the time for it." "I like sailing. Got a friend with a Hobie Cat. They're fun."
Jamie took a deep breath of salt air. "The first time I saw the ocean, I must have been 4 or 5 years old. My parents had just moved to Berkeley from New Mexico, and I thought the bay was all the water in the world. Then they took me to the beach, and I saw the Pacific. Damn breakers scared the shit out of me."
"What are y'all gonna do now?"
Edith asked, forgetting her diction lessons. Jamie kept his eyes on the calm water, the ripples of waves riding across the pastel, green-blue water to foam briefly against the sand beach. From this height, he could barely hear the hiss of the gentle surf.
"Look for a job, I guess."
"At the university or in private industry?" What the hell could I do in private industry that a kid 10 years younger can't? He snapped, then immediately regretted it. More calmly. University. But not here. I don't want to be this close to the Mars mission. Not now.
Up in Austin?
Maybe. California might be better. More likely Albuquerque. He turned to her. I don't know. It's too soon.
But you're going to be leaving.
Yes. I think so. He realized that she was trying to hide the pain that she felt. Pulling her to him, Jamie held her tightly. Edith did not cry, but he could feel the tension constricting her body. He wished she would cry. He wished he could, himself. It was 2 a.m. when the phone call came. The buzz of the phone jangled Jamie awake instantly, but for several blurry moments he did not know where he was. The phone shrilled again, insistently. He realized Edith was beside him, stirring now, mumbling into her pillow. His eyes adjusting to the glow of the digital clock on the dresser, Jamie reached across her naked body and lifted the phone from its base. Hello?
James Waterman?
Who wants to know?
Come now, Jamie. This is Anthony Reed in Star City. Do you have any idea how long it's taken me to track you down?
Christ, it's 2 a.m. here. What the hell do you want?
DiNardo's in hospital. A gallbladder attack. He'll need surgery.
Jamie sat up rigidly in the bed. What's happening? Edith asked, awake now.
Did you hear me?
Reed asked. It was the first time that Jamie had ever heard the Englishman sound excited. Yes.
There's a god-awful row going on upstairs. Brumado's flying in from the States, from what I hear. He wants to meet with the selection board and Dr. Lee.
So Hoffman's moved up to 1, and I'll be his backup? Jamie asked, surprised at the tremor in his voice.
Can't be certain of anything right now,
Reed answered.
The entire question is going to be reviewed this afternoon or Sunday.
What is it? Edith was excited now, too. Have they changed their minds?
Whatever you do,
Reed was saying,
stay in close touch with Houston. You may have to fly out here on Monday, or perhaps go straight up to the space station. We were supposed to start shipping up there tomorrow, but everything's been put on hold temporarily.
Okay, Jamie said shakily. Thanks for letting me know.
Nothing to it, old boy. Most of us would much rather have you aboard than that prig Hoffman.
Thanks.
Good luck.
The line clicked dead. What is it? Edith asked, sitting up beside him. Jamie realized his hands were trembling. Father DiNardo's been taken sick. He's going into surgery. It looks like I'll be going on the mission after all. Hot spit! Edith dove out of the bed and began rummaging in her shoulder bag, resting on the chair next to the curtained window. Jamie watched her slim, naked figure as she bent over the bag, muttering to herself. Ha! Got it! She bounced back into the bed with a palm-sized tape recorder in her hand. What the hell? Jamie wondered. This is an on-the-scene interview with geologist James Fox Waterman, who has just been informed that he has been selected to be on the team that flies to the planet Mars 2 months from now. He laughed, but apparently Edith was completely serious. Dr. Waterman, how do you feel about being selected to be part of the first human expedition to the planet Mars? Jamie blurted, horny, very horny. He took the tape recorder from her hand and placed it on the night table beside her. The tape ran out long before they finished making love. 2. As the cab pulled up to the curb in front of his parents' home, Jamie realized for the first time how undistinguished the house was. Genteel poverty was the facade for university professors, even those who had inherited old money. He had hitched a ride in the back seat of a T-18 jet with one of the NASA astronauts who was dashing home to the Bay Area for a quick weekend. Now, as he paid the cab driver and got out onto the sidewalk, he felt almost as if he had stepped onto a movie set. Middle-class Americana. A quiet suburban street. Unpretentious little bungalows. Kids on bicycles. Lawn sprinklers cranking back and forth. He went up the walk, nylon travel bag in one hand, feeling a little unreal. How would Norman Rockwell paint this scene? Hello, Mom. Just dropped in for a few hours to tell you that I'm off to Mars. Before he could reach the front door, his mother was there waiting for him, a smile on her lips and the beginnings of tears in her eyes. Lucille Monroe Waterman was a small woman, pert and beautiful, who had been born to the considerable wealth of an old New England family that dated itself back to the Mayflower. The first time her family had allowed her to venture west of the Hudson River was the summer she had spent on a dude ranch in the mountains of northern New Mexico. There she had met Jerome Waterman, a young Navajo fiercely intent on becoming a teacher of history. Real history, Jerry Waterman told her, the actual facts about the Native Americans and what the European invaders did to them. They fell hopelessly, passionately in love with each other. So much so that Lucille, who had not given much thought to a career, entered the academic life too. So much so that they were married despite her parents' obvious misgivings. Jerry Waterman wrote his history of the Native Americans, and it was eventually adopted as the definitive text by universities all across the nation. Success, marriage, the comfort of a dependable income, the insulated life of academia, all these mellowed him to the point where Lucille's family could almost accept him as their daughter's husband. And Jerry Waterman found that he wanted to be accepted. It was important to Lucille. It became important to him. Lucille won her doctorate in English literature, and then they had a baby, James Fox Waterman, the Fox being an ancient family name from Lucille's mother's side of the clan. Although he could not know it, Jamie was the grandson that brought about the true reconciliation of the New Englanders and their Navajo son-in-law. Lucille clung to Jamie there in the doorway of their Berkeley home as if she wanted never to let him go. Then his father appeared, smiling calmly from behind his pipe. No one would recognize Professor Jerome Waterman as the fiery young champion of Native American history. His hair was iron gray and thinning so much that he combed it forward to cover his high forehead. His face showed what Jamie might be like in 30 years, fleshy, puffy from a sedentary life, dark-rimmed glasses, open-necked sports shirt with its manufacturer's logo embroidered discreetly on the chest. There was no more fire in Jerry Waterman's dark eyes. It had been a long time since he had been in a fight more strenuous than arguing with the dean over class size. He had won his youthful battles, and over the years had become more like his former enemies than he could possibly admit to himself. "I can only say overnight," were the first words Jamie actually spoke to his parents.
"On the phone you said they were sending you to Mars?"
His mother looked more frightened than proud.
"I think so. It looks that way."
"When will you know for sure?" his father asked.
They walked him into the book-lined library, where the bright sunshine was blocked from the window by a tall azalea bush that threatened to undermine the house's foundation one day.
"Monday, I guess. I won't have a chance to get away once they make their final decision."
The house was much as Jamie remembered it. Comfortable, disordered, books and journals scattered everywhere, upholstered chairs and chintz-covered sofas that bore the imprint of his mother's and his father's bodies. "Mama Bear has her chair, and Papa Bear has his," Jamie remembered from childhood. He sat on the edge of the library sofa, tense and nervous. Mama and Papa took their individual chairs, facing him.
"You really want to go?"
his mother asked for the 1,000th time in the past 4 years. Jamie nodded.
"I thought that priest was the one they picked," said his father.
"He came down with a gallbladder attack. Too much wine, I guess."
None of them so much as smiled. The afternoon and evening inched along. Jamie could see that his mother did not want him to go, that she was desperately trying to think of some argument, some reason that would keep him safely near her. His father seemed bemused by the whole matter, pleased that his son was at last finding some measure of success, but uncertain about the wisdom of the entire effort. Over dinner, his father said,
"I've never been able to satisfy myself that Mars is worth all the money we're spending on it."
Jamie felt a wave of relief wash through him. It was easier to debate national policy than to watch his mother struggling to hold back tears. They went through all the arguments, pro and con, that they had disputed back and forth with his every visit home. Without rancor, without polemics, without raising their voices or stirring their blood, like a classroom exercise. As he discussed the question of Mars in calm debater's logic, Jamie realized that his father had become the complete academic. Nothing really touched him anymore. He saw everything in the abstract. Not even the obvious pain of his wife sitting across the table 3 feet from him could shake him out of the comfortable cocoon he had woven around himself. "My God," Jamie thought, "Dad's gotten old, bloodless and old. Is that the way I'm going to be?" It was not until long after dinner was finished, as he started upstairs toward the bedroom he had slept in since childhood, that his mother asked,
"Must you leave tomorrow? Can't you stay just a little longer?"
"I can't take another day of this," Jamie knew. As gently as he could, he told his mother, "I've got to be at the Space Center first thing Monday morning."
"But you don't have to leave so soon, do you?"
He hesitated. "I want to see Grandfather Al."
"Oh."
The one syllable carried a lifetime of grief and distaste. His father overheard them and came into the hallway.
"You'd rather be with your grandfather than with your mother?" he asked sharply.
Jimmy was surprised at that, almost glad of it. "He's the only grandparent I've got left. It doesn't seem right to go without saying goodbye to him." Jerome Waterman huffed, but said nothing more. 3. Jamie had to be satisfied with a commercial flight from Oakland International to Albuquerque. Al was waiting for him at the airport, with a rental helicopter and pilot.
"What's this all about?"
Jamie asked as he clambered into the little glass bubble chopper. Al was grinning broadly, his leathery face a geological map of happiness.
"You only got a few hours here, right? Thought we'd take a run up to Mesa Verde instead of sitting around the house."
"Mesa Verde?"
Jamie yelled over the whine of the copter engine startup.
"You're not going mystical on me, are you?"
Al laughed.
"Maybe. We'll see."
The first snow of the season was already on the mountains, and Jamie felt cold in his lightweight windbreaker as he and Al trekked through the well-marked trail from the helicopter landing pad to the rim of the canyon.
"I should have brought a couple of coats,"
Al muttered. He was in a worn old denim jacket and jeans.
"It's okay. The sun's warming things up."
The sky was cloudless blue. Big dollops of wet snow were melting out of the ponderosas and pinyons, dropping like scoops of ice cream to splatter on the gravel trail. Jamie's high-tech Reeboks were getting soaked. Al wore his usual boots, tough and comfortable, and his drooping, broad-brimmed hat protected his head from the falling snow. Jamie, bareheaded, had to keep an eye on the trees and dodge the falls. The air was thin up this high. Jamie heard his grandfather wheezing. He had seen the Anasazi ruins before, of course, but for some reason, Al wanted him to see them once again before he took off for another world. They reached the crest of the high ridge, walked along the edge for a few silent, puffing minutes, then stepped out from behind a stand of pine. Across a bend in the ridge, 100 feet down, the old ruins huddled in a cleft of the ancient solid stone. Even to this day, the adobe brick buildings were protected from the wind and snow by the overhanging rock. Reddish-brown sandstone, Jamie knew, almost the same color as Mars.
"Your ancestors built that village 500 years before Columbus was born," Al said quietly.
"I know," said Jamie.
"Son, when you go to Mars, you'll be taking them with you. The old ones. They're in your blood."
Jamie smiled at his grandfather.
"By God, Al, you are going mystical."
His grandfather's face was entirely serious.
"It's important for a man to know who he is. You can't be in balance without that. You can't know where you're heading for if you don't know where you come from."
"I understand, grandfather."
"Your father..."
Al hesitated. The old man had never called him his son as long as Jamie could remember.
"Your father turned his back on all this. He wanted to be accepted by the whites so badly. He turned himself into an Anglo."
"I don't blame him. It's my own fault, I guess. I didn't teach him half of what I've taught you, Jamie. I was too busy then with the store and all. I didn't take the time to raise him like I should have."
"It's not your fault, Al."
"I think it is. I wasn't as good a father to him as I've been a grandfather to you. I can see why he felt he had to take the path he did. But I want you to remember who you are, son. You'll be traveling where no one has gone before. You'll be facing dangers no one's ever dealt with. It'll go better for you if you remember all this. Keep it in your mind. Always."
Looking out on the ancient adobe village, the square dwellings with their empty windows, the brick-walled circles of kivas where the men held their religious ceremonies in the heady smoke of precious tobacco, Jamie nodded to his grandfather.
"I knew you would go to Mars,"
Al said, his voice almost cracking.
Never had the slightest doubt that you'd go.
I'll remember this, Jamie said. I'll keep it in my heart. Al reached into the pocket of his denim jacket.
Here, he said. A reminder.
Jamie saw that his grandfather was offering him a carved piece of jet-black obsidian in the totem shape of a crouching bear. A tiny turquoise arrowhead was tied to its back with a leather thong, with a wisp of a white feather tucked atop it. A fetish, Jamie realized, a protective piece of Navajo magic.
That's an eagle feather, Al said, unable to suppress his shopkeeper's pride.
Jamie took the fetish. It was small in his palm, but weighty, solid, strong.
I'll keep this with me every minute, Grandfather.
Al grinned, almost embarrassed.
Go with beauty, son.
4. Jamie made it back to Houston Sunday night and crawled into his apartment bed emotionally exhausted. While he slept, his future was decided, more than 10,000 kilometers away in Star City. Alberto Brumado dozed in a limousine that had met his plane on its arrival in Moscow. Alone in the spacious back seat, jet-lagged by his supersonic flight from Washington, Brumado paid no attention to the lines of tall apartment blocks and low gray clouds that stretched eastward toward the true steppe country of Russia. For more than an hour, the car sped along the wide concrete highway. Traffic thinned away until there was little more than the occasional massive tractor-trailer rig, diesel engine belching sooty exhaust plumes into the air. Past Kaliningrad they drove, past woods and lakes, and over a railroad crossing, heading toward Star City. The actual name of the community is Vyazny Gorodok, literally, Starry Town. But ever since the first cooperative Soviet-American space venture, the Apollo-Soyuz mission of 1975, a slight misinterpretation by a NASA translator turned it into Star City, and so it has been called by the Western media ever since. Once it had been a town, nothing more than a handful of apartment blocks and a dozen big concrete buildings that housed the Cosmonaut Training Center, deliberately placed in the barren emptiness between a thick pine forest and a scattering of small lakes. Now, as Alberto Brumado's car drove past the guard post at the perimeter fence, it had grown into a sizable city. Scientists and astronauts from all over the world trained here for Mars. The world's media focused their attention here. A true city had grown around the clear blue lakes, homes for workers who served the training center, shops and open-air markets, and entertainment complexes. Close by the main gate of the training center itself stood the Space Museum, a gracefully sweeping concrete form that captured the spirit of flight. Brumado had learned the traveler's secret years earlier. Sleep whenever you can. Now, as the limousine pulled up to the main office building at the training center, he roused himself from his nap, ready to step out and face his responsibilities, alert, if not actually refreshed. Dr. Li Chengdu came almost loping down the front steps of the building on his long legs to greet Brumado and guide him to the office that the Russians had set aside for his use. Dr. Li was wearing an expensive-looking running suit of maroon and slate gray. The white pinstripe down the legs made him look even taller and leaner than usual. His face seemed strained, grayish, almost ill. Perhaps it's that maroon top, Brumado thought. It's not good for his coloring. He himself was still in his Washington clothes, a dark blue business suit. He had removed the tie and stuffed it into his jacket pocket hours earlier. The shirt was limp and wrinkled from his long trip. The office to which Lee escorted him was big enough to contain a broad, polished conference table, Brumado saw. Good. And its own lavatory. Even better. The second rule of the inveterate traveler, never pass a toilet without using it. 3 minutes later, his bladder emptied, his face washed, and his hair freshly combed, Brumado pulled out a chair from the middle of the conference table, ignoring the massive desk and the high-backed swivel chair behind it. Brumado felt he was here to help solve a sudden problem, not to impress others with the trappings of power. Besides, he told himself, I have no real power here, no authority over these men and women. My strength lies in moral persuasion, nothing more. Dr. Lee was pacing the office from the draped windows to the head of the conference table and back again, more nervous than Brumado had ever seen him.
"Please sit here next to me," Brumado said mildly. "It hurts my neck to look up at you."
Lee's thin, ascetic face looked startled momentarily, then apologetic. He took the chair next to Brumado's.
"You seem very upset," Brumado said. "What is wrong?"
Lee drummed his long fingers on the tabletop before answering.
"We seem to have a virtual mutiny on our hands, and your daughter, sir, is apparently the ringleader."
"Johanna?"
"Once it became clear that DiNardo could not make the mission, your daughter, and others, demanded that Professor Hoffman be replaced as well."
Brumado felt confused. "Johanna would never do such a thing, never."
"I don't understand," he said. "Your daughter and several other scientists here have refused to go on the mission if Hoffman is included. It is mutiny, pure and simple."
"Mutiny?" Brumado echoed, feeling dull, stupid, as if his brain could not grasp the meaning of Lee's words.
"We cannot announce the final selections for the mission. We cannot begin transporting the scientific staff to the assembly station in orbit if they refuse to go."
Lee's voice was high and strained, nearly cracking. Brumado had never seen Lee like this, close to panic.
"What can we do?"
Lee asked, raising his hands in a gesture of helplessness.
"We cannot tell Professor Hoffman that he has been removed from flight status because a cabal of his fellow scientists don't like him. What can we do?"
Brumado took in a deep breath, unconsciously trying to calm Lee by calming himself.
"I think the first thing I should do is speak to my daughter." "Yes," Lee said. "Certainly."
He sprang up from the chair, all 6.5 feet of him, and nearly sprinted to the desk where the phone was. Brumado wormed out of his jacket and tossed it onto another chair. He was rolling up his shirt sleeves when Johanna stepped into the office. She, too, was wearing a softly comfortable running suit, butter yellow and muted orange. Brumado wondered idly what the Russians thought about this craze for American fashion.
"I will leave the two of you alone," said Lee softly, nearly whispering.
He scurried from the room like a wisp of smoke wafted away on a strong breeze. Johanna came over to her father, bussed him on both cheeks, and sat in the chair that Lee had used earlier. Brumado studied her face. She looked serious, but not upset, more determined than fearful.
"Dr. Lee tells me you are leading a mutiny among the scientists." Brumado found himself smiling at her as he said it.
Not only did he find it difficult to believe such an outrageous story, but even if it were true, he could not be angry with his lovely daughter.
"We took a vote last night," Johanna said in their native Brazilian Portuguese. "Out of the 16 scientists scheduled to fly the mission, 11 will not go if Hoffman is included."
Brumado brushed his upper lip with a fingertip, a throwback to his youth when he had sported a luxuriant mustache.
"The 16 includes Hoffman himself. Did he vote?"
Johanna laughed.
"No, of course not. We did not ask him."
"Why?" her father asked.
"What is the reason for this?"
She made a small sigh.
"None of us really likes Hoffman. He is a very difficult personality. We feel that it will be impossible to work with him under the very close conditions of the mission."
"But why wait until now? Why didn't you say something sooner?"
"We thought that Father DiNardo could keep Hoffman under control. Hoffman admired DiNardo, looked up to him. But the thought of having Hoffman without Father DiNardo, having him as the prime geologist for the mission, we realized we could not stand that. He would be insufferable, unbearable."
Brumado said nothing, thinking, "I'm not going into space with them. I'm not going to be cooped up inside a spacecraft for nearly 2 years with someone I can't stand."
"Besides," his daughter went on, "Hoffman was chosen mainly for political reasons. You know that."
"He is an excellent geologist," Brumado replied absently, thinking now about the difficulties he was asking his daughter to face. 2 years in space. The stresses. The dangers.
"There are other geologists who have gone through training with us," Johanna said, leaning slightly closer to her father. "O'Hara is from Australia. He can move up. And there is that Navajo mestizo, Waterman."
Brumado's attention suddenly focused on his daughter's eyes.
the man who stayed on at McMurdo to help your group through your Antarctic training. And the following groups, yes, him. And O'Hara. Waterman has done extensive work on meteor impacts. He even found a Martian meteorite in Antarctica, although Hoffman took the credit for it. Is he the man you want? She pulled back again. I think he is the best qualified person, isn't he? And everyone seemed to get along with him very well. But he's an American, Brumado muttered. The politicians don't want more Americans than Russians, or vice versa. He's an American Indian, Papa. It's not really the same thing. And O'Hara will make the Australians happy. The politicians wanted Hoffman to help represent Europe. We already have a Greek, a Pole, and a German to represent Europe, as well as an Englishman. If Hoffman goes on the mission, there will be trouble, Johanna said firmly. His psychological profile is awful. We have tried to work with him, Papa. He is simply unbearable. So you took a vote? Yes. We have decided. If Hoffman is chosen, there are at least 11 of us who will resign from the program immediately. Again, Brumado fell silent. He did not know what to say, how to handle this situation. Ask Anthony Reed, Johanna suggested. He has had more training in psychology than any of the others selected for the mission. It was his idea to take the vote. Was it? Yes. I didn't do all this by myself, Papa. Most of the others cannot stand Hoffman. Brumado got up slowly and went to the desk. Picking up the telephone, he asked the man who answered to find Dr. Reed. The Englishman opened the office door before Brumado could return to the conference table. My God, he thought, they must all be sitting in the outer office. I wonder if Hoffman is there too. Reed seemed faintly amused by it all. None of us can get along with Hoffman, he said, smiling slightly as he sat relaxed in a chair across the table from Brumado and his daughter. Frankly, I think bringing him along to Mars would be a disaster. Always have. But he passed all the psychological tests. Reed arched an eyebrow. So would a properly motivated chimpanzee. But you wouldn't want to live in the same cage with him, would you? You've all been filling out cross-evaluation reports for the past 2 years. Brumado heard his own voice rising with more than a hint of anger in it. He forced it down. I admit that the reports written about Professor Hoffman have not been glowing, but there has been no hint that he was so disliked. I couldn't tell you about his evaluation reports, Reed said, almost smirking. No one ever expressed their true feelings in the reports, not in writing. There is enormous psychological pressure to put a good face on everything. Every one of us realized straight from the outset that those reports would be a reflection on the person who wrote them as much as on the person they were writing about. Brumado thought, we should have realized that from the beginning. These are very bright men and women, bright enough to see all the possibilities. Reed continued. To borrow a phrase from Scotland Yard, we understood that anything we wrote in those evaluation forms might be taken down in evidence and used against us. With a shake of his head, Brumado said, I still can't understand why you waited until this very last moment to bring your opposition out into the open. Two reasons, actually, said Reed. First, we all expected that Donato could keep Hoffman under control. Our good priest seemed to have a calming effect on the Austrian, rather like old Hindenburg had on Hitler. Johanna barely suppressed a giggle. Second, I suppose that none of us actually faced up to the awful possibility of spending nearly 2 years living cheek by jowl with Hoffman until this very weekend, with the final decisions made and Donato packing off to hospital. Well, I suppose it suddenly dawned on us that Hoffman simply wouldn't do. How do I tell this to Professor Hoffman? Brumado asked softly. Oh, I'd be willing to tackle that chore, Reed said at once. I'd be almost happy to do it. Brumado shook his head sadly. No, it is not your responsibility. He dismissed Reed and asked Dr. Lee to come back into the office. With Johanna still sitting beside him, Brumado said wearily, I suppose there is no way around it. Professor Hoffman will have to be told. Lee seemed to have calmed down considerably. His mask of impassivity was in place once more. It is my duty to inform him, Lee said. If you like, I will explain it to him, said Brumado. With a quick glance at Johanna, Lee murmured, As you wish.
Hoffman looked as tense as a stalking leopard when he entered the office. He stood a moment at the door, eyeing Lee, Brumado, and Joanna with unconcealed suspicion. Short, round-shouldered, his round pie face pale with tension. He was wearing a powder-blue cardigan sweater buttoned neatly over a shirt and tie striped yellow and red. His slacks were dark blue, almost black. "Please," called Brumado from the conference table, "come in and sit down." Lee was standing at the end of the table, as far from the door as possible. Joanna still sat next to her father, turned toward Hoffman so that Brumado could not see her face. As if stepping through a minefield, Hoffman walked across the carpeted floor and pulled out the chair at the head of the table. He sat down. "We have run into a difficulty," said Brumado, trying to smile disarmingly and not quite making it.
"They are all against me. I know that."
Brumado felt his eyebrows rise.
"We must think of the good of the mission. That is our paramount duty." Hoffman's face twisted.
"I was chosen by the selection board. I demand that their choice be upheld."
"If we uphold that decision, the mission will be wrecked. More than half your fellow scientists have refused to go, I am sorry to say."
"More than half?"
Brumado nodded.
"This is an affront to the entire nation of Austria."
"No," said Dr. Lee from the other end of the table. "It is entirely a personal matter. There are no politics involved here. It is all personalities."
"Yes, I see."
Hoffman jabbed a finger toward Joanna.
"She wants that American Indian by her side, so I am to be thrown off."
Brumado felt his jaw drop open.
"What are you saying?"
Joanna demanded.
"I know very well how you and the Apache or Navajo or whatever he is, the two of you at the McMurdo..."
"Nothing happened between us," Joanna said, turning to her father. "He's lying. There was nothing."
Brumado raised his hand, and she fell silent. To Hoffman, he said,
"I can see that there are stresses here and strained relationships that could cause a disaster for the mission to Mars."
Hoffman glared, his face reddening.
"I know it is an enormous sacrifice, but I must ask you to resign from the mission," Brumado said.
"Never,"
Hoffman snapped.
"And if you try to force me out, I will tell the world's media that you have thrown me out in favor of your daughter's lover."
Joanna looked stunned, stricken, speechless. One of Alberto Brumado's traits was that the angrier he became, the more icy calm. Anger that would drive another man to tantrums or violence merely made him colder, keener, more deliberate.
"Professor Hoffman," he said, clasping his hands prayerfully on the tabletop, "if you ask me to choose between your claim and my daughter's denial, do you think for an instant that I would believe you?"
"They were lovers. I am certain of it."
"You have proven, merely in these few minutes, that it would be disastrous to include you on the Mars team."
"I will appeal to the Board of Selection, and to the media."
As patiently as a physician detailing the risks of surgery, Brumado said,
"The Board of Selection cannot and will not override the wishes of the exploration team. And if you go to the media, we will be forced to reveal that most of the scientists on the team dislike you so much that they have refused to go on the mission if you are included."
Hoffman's nostrils flared, his eyes glittered with rage.
"Whatever happens, what do you think the effect on your reputation will be? How will your university react to such notoriety? Do you know what it's like to have the media hounding you night and day?"
The Austrian looked away from Brumado, glanced at Lee, then turned his gaze toward the ceiling.
"I urge you," Brumado said, reasonably, placatingly, remorselessly, "to tender your resignation. For the good of your career, for the sake of your wife, for the sake of this mission, please, please, do not allow pride or anger to ruin the human race's first attempt to explore the planet Mars. I beg of you."
Lee said,
"We can see to it that your university gets first priority in analyzing the soil samples and rocks returned from the mission. Or, if you wish," Brumado added, "we can help you to get an appointment at the university of your choice, and you can analyze the samples there."
"You are offering me a bribe,"
Hoffman growled.
"Yes," said Brumado. "Quite frankly, I would offer anything I could to save this mission.
It is in your hands, Lee said in a near whisper. Brumado saw that the shock on his daughter's face had been replaced by something deeper than anger. Hatred, he realized. He put a calming hand on her shoulder and felt the tension that coiled within her.
Hoffman muttered, My wife never wanted me to go to Mars.
You can have a very prestigious position, Dr. Lee coaxed. Leader of the scientific analysis of the Mars samples.
No announcements have been made about the final team choices, Brumado reminded him. There would be no embarrassment for you.
Suddenly, tears sprang from Hoffman's eyes.
What can I do? You're all against me. Even my wife.
His head drooped to the tabletop, cradled in his arms, and he began to sob uncontrollably. Brumado turned toward Lee, feeling like a torturer, a murderer.
I will take care of him, Lee said softly. Please go now, both of you, and send in Dr. Reed if he's still outside. Otherwise, ask the secretary to summon a physician.
Brumado pushed his chair back and slowly rose to his feet. His daughter still showed nothing but contempt for the sobbing man huddled at the head of the table. The mission is saved, Brumado found himself thinking. That is the important thing. The mission will go on, despite this poor, wretched man. 5. It was still dark when the phone woke Jamie. He struggled up from a dream of ancient men trying to build a tower on the windswept top of a bare, grassless mesa. The bricks kept melting away in the hot sunshine. The tower never rose higher than his own reach. The phone buzzed insistently. Jamie finally opened his eyes, remembered that he was back in his own apartment again, alone, and groped for the telephone on the bedside table. The digital clock read 6:26 a.m. There was no hint of sunrise through the drawn blinds of the bedroom window.
Dr. Waterman?
A man's voice asked crisply.
Right?
This is an official message from Kaliningrad. I am Yegorov, personnel section.
Yes? Jimmy was instantly wide awake.
You are to report to the Johnson Space Center at 800 hours local time and receive your orders for immediate transportation to the Kennedy Space Center in Florida. From there, you will board the space shuttle for transport to the orbital assembly facility.
You mean I'm going to Mars? Jamie shouted into the phone.
Oh, yes. Did you not know? You have been selected as geologist on the first landing team. Good luck.
Jamie's first impulse was to give an ear-splitting war whoop. But instead, he merely said, Thank you. He hung up, suddenly feeling hollow inside, empty, as if he had finally pushed through a door that had been locked against him and found that it opened onto thin air. He got out of bed, showered, shaved, repacked his well-used travel bag, and drove out to the center. Sure enough, there was a team of grinning men and women at the travel office waiting for him.
A plane will be ready for you at the airstrip in about half an hour.
What about my car? Jamie suddenly realized he had made no plans about the car, the apartment, his furniture. Absurdly, he wondered what to do with his magazine and journal subscriptions.
We'll take care of all the details. Just sign these forms.
Jamie scribbled his name without reading the forms.
Fuck it, he thought. They can have the car and everything else. Won't need it on Mars.
They drove him to the airstrip. The whole roomful of clerks piled into one gray agency station wagon, pressing against Jamie, wanting to be as close as they could be to the man who was going to Mars. Jamie did not mind the closeness. He was thankful for the ride. He did not want himself to drive. The excitement was getting to him.
Mars! Geologist on the first landing team. Mars!
Edith was standing at the entrance to the hangar, in jeans and a light sweater. Obviously not her working clothes. He suddenly felt ashamed for not phoning her.
How'd you know? He asked,
travel bag in one hand. She grinned up at him.
I have my sources. I work in news, you know.
Jamie did not know what to say. The clerks who had driven him here, the airplane mechanics, there were too many people watching them. Edith's grin turned rueful.
Well, we knew it wouldn't last forever.
It was fun, though. I think the world of you, Edith.
Only this world, though. Now you got another one to think about.
Yes. He laughed, feeling shaky, unsure. She twined her arms around his neck and kissed him,
soundly.
Good luck, Jamie. Best luck in two worlds to you.
All he could think to say was, I'll be back. She answered, sure you will. Sol 3. Morning.
Today's the big day, huh?
Despite the fact that he had been a jet fighter pilot and an astronaut with more than 20 shuttle missions on his record, Pete Connors reminded Jamie of a high school football player moments before the opening kickoff. His dark brown eyes, usually sorrowful, now showed an excitement that most men lose after their teen years, a barely suppressed sense of adventure. Connors, Jamie, and most of the others were suiting up for their first day of actual scientific work on Mars. Bright sunshine streamed through the clear, double-walled plastic of the inflated dome's lower section. The weather forecast was for a typical late summer day. Clear skies, light wind, high temperature climbing up into the 60s after an overnight low of -112. The big day, Jamie agreed, tugging on the sky-blue outer pants of his hard suit. They dressed in layers. First, the form-fitting underwear that was honeycombed with thin, flexible water tubes. The water carried away body heat and kept the wearer at a reasonable temperature inside the heavily insulated hard suit. Next came the fabric coveralls, and then the hard suit itself, built to contain a normal terrestrial air pressure of roughly 14 pounds per square inch inside, even if there were nothing but pure vacuum on the other side of its metal and plastic shell. You leaned against a locker and laboriously tugged the hard suit pants over your hips. The torso shell stood on a rack so you could duck under it and slide your arms through the sleeves while pushing your head through the bright metal ring of the neck seal. Once inside the suit, it was virtually impossible to bend over to pull on the boots. The explorers always dressed in pairs and helped each other with the boots and the backpacks that held the air regenerator, batteries, heater, pumps, and fans of the life support system. The first time Jamie had tried to don a hard suit back on Earth, it had taken more than an hour and seemed like a particularly sophisticated combination of torture and humiliation. The first time he had tried it in Martian gravity, as their spacecraft approached the red planet, things had gone much more easily. Now, however, he was getting accustomed to the light gravity of Mars, and putting on the suit was becoming a chore again. Eight of the team were preparing to go outside the dome, struggling into their suits like a short-handed football team getting into its padding and uniforms, or like knights putting on their armor. Jamie wondered if King Arthur's men grumbled and swore while they suited up for battle. Their dressing area was a line of racks and lockers where the suits were stored, with a pair of long plastic benches laid out in front of them. Built for Martian gravity, the benches looked to Jamie to be too thin to sit on safely, their slim legs too far apart. But Connors thumped down on one, suit and all, to let Jamie help him into his heavy, cleated boots. The others were doing the same, Jamie saw. The benches sagged slightly under the weight, but only slightly. Boots zippered, Connors got up and stamped his feet on the plastic flooring.
Good, he said, nodding from inside the suit. Now let's get yours on.
Jamie sat warily. He noticed Ilona Maliter standing beside Joanna, both of them fully suited except for their helmets, talking together softly and earnestly like school chums or sisters. Biochemist and microbiologist, Jamie thought that of all the scientists brought to Mars, the two of them had the most to gain. Or lose. If they found any evidence for life at all, they would become international celebrities. But if they failed to find any evidence of life, the whole world, perhaps even the scientific community, would always wonder if they had overlooked something. Was that why the board picked all women for the life sciences? The third member of the bio team was Monique Bonnet, the French geochemist who had taken a cram course in paleontology just in case they should discover fossils in the red sands or rocks. The tall Israeli leaned closer to Joanna and said something that made her smile, then cover her mouth with a hand to keep from laughing out loud. They're looking at me, Jamie realized. All the others were already in their suits waiting to go. I'm the laggard. He was sitting on the bench, hands clenched on its back edge with one leg raised up so that his foot rested approximately in Connor's groin. The women find that funny, Jamie thought, his face reddening.
That's it, friend, said Connors.
Jamie put his leg down and got to his feet. The suit felt cumbersome, stiff. He clomped past the rack where it had hung, now looking like a pathetic dead plastic tree, and took his helmet from the shelf atop it. He started to put it on, more to hide his blushing than anything else.
"Gloves," Connor said. "You don't want to go outside without your gloves, man."
Flustered, Jamie yanked his gloves from the clip on the rack and tucked them into the pouch on his right thigh. He had carefully placed the fetish his grandfather had given him in the left thigh pouch. It was small enough so that no one noticed him doing it. Following Connors and the others, he walked toward the airlock and the next set of racks, where the backpacks waited.
"Got to remember to do everything by the numbers," Connors told him as he helped Jamie into the backpack.
"Right.
It's not so bad now. Everything's new. We're all real aware of what we're doing. But later on, a few days from now or a few weeks, when it's all so routine we don't even think about it, that's when you can make a mistake that'll kill you, or kill somebody else."
Jamie nodded. He knew that Connors was right. Mission regulations insisted that one astronaut be part of the team whenever anyone went outside the dome. The astronaut served as safety officer. His responsibility was to make certain that all safety rules were strictly followed. His authority was absolute.
"What's your assignment for today?" Jamie asked as he turned to help Connors. "Or are you just going outside to watch us like a safety patrolman?"
Glancing back over his shoulder at Jamie, Connors said,
"Sure, I got a job. Decontamination and cleanup. I gotta make sure all of us clean off whatever dust we pick up on our suits before we come back inside again."
Before Jamie could say anything, Connors added,
"You know they'd make the black man into the janitor, don't you?"
For a moment, Jamie felt startled, upset. Then Connors broke into a toothy grin.
"My main task this morning is taping a TV show for the kids back home."
Jamie felt relieved. Connors had never shown the slightest trace of ill humor. He seemed always cheerful, not an angry bone in his body.
"I'm going to be Dr. Science on Mars. Show the local scenery, do a few simple demonstrations of the low air pressure and gravity. For educational TV, I'll be a media star all around the world."
Laughing, Jamie said, "Good for you." At last they were all ready. Jamie remembered to pull on his gloves and seal them to the metal cuffs of his suit. The backs of the gloves were ridged like an external skeleton of slim plastic bones. The palms and fingertips were clear plastic, hardly thicker than kitchen cling wrap. Like the others, Jamie took the tools he needed for the morning's work and clipped them to the web belt at his waist. Rock pick, scoop, corer, sample bags. He held in one hand the long, telescoping titanium pole that could serve as a lever or extended handle.
"A true spear carrier."
Jamie turned to see Joanna standing beside him, a lovely butterfly trapped inside a glaring orange cocoon. Both her hands were filled with bulky, silvered cases.
"You look like an encyclopedia salesman," he said.
She blinked, puzzled.
"Okay, listen up," Connors called to them. "We go through the airlock in Noah's Ark fashion, two by two. Visors down, everybody."
Joanna had to put her instrument cases on the floor before she could deal with her helmet visor.
"Check seals and airflow."
Connor's melodious voice now came humming through the helmet earphones. The astronaut personally checked each of the scientists before starting them through the airlock. He and Monique Bonnet went through together, clean white and tricolor blue. Then Patel in his butter-yellow suit, with Naguib Kelly green. Ilona and Toshima were next, the green of her suit a shade or two darker than the Egyptians, while the Japanese meteorologist's softly peach-colored suit bristled with instruments and equipment that dangled from every conceivable type of belt and harness. Jamie thought that Toshima barely was able to raise his booted feet over the lip of the airlock hatch. If he ever trips and falls, it'll take two of us to haul him back up to his feet. Finally, it was Jamie's turn, with Joanna. The two Russians, Abel and Tony Reed, remained inside. Mironov and Reed were assigned to monitor the scientists on the surface. The hard suits had instrumentation built into them that automatically reported on body temperature, heart and breathing rate, and oxygen-carbon dioxide ratio inside the suit. Astronaut Abel ran the comm console, maintaining contact with the expedition command in orbit, while Voznesensky watched everybody and everything with the eye of a Russian eagle. With its visor down, Jamie's hard suit served as a shell that protected him from the gaze of others. He was glad of it. He had been embarrassed minutes earlier, and now he felt his stomach fluttering and his palms getting damp. It was not fear so much as anticipation. He was about to step out onto the surface of Mars and begin the work that he had dreamed about for so many years. "Let me go in beauty," he found himself thinking. "Let me find harmony and beauty out there." The noise of the airlock pumps dwindled down until Jamie could only feel their vibration through his boots. The telltale light on the tiny control panel turned red, indicating that the chamber had been pumped down to the ambient pressure outside. He leaned on the control button, and the outer hatch sighed open a crack. Pushing it all the way open, Jamie waited until Joanna went through before he stepped out onto the sandy red, rock-strewn desert to begin his morning's work. Like almost everything else about the mission, the selection of their landing site had been a political compromise. The biologists had wanted to land near the polar cap, where, beneath the layers of ice and frozen carbon dioxide, there might be hidden pools of liquid water and some form of life. Experiments conducted by unmanned landing probes, starting with the original Viking 1 and 2 back in 1976, had shown that there was unusual chemical activity in the Martian soil. Could life exist in that soil if there was liquid water available? The geologists could not make up their minds where they wanted to land, with an entire strange new world to sink their picks into. There were massive volcanoes to study, a rift valley longer than the distance from New York to San Francisco, regions where meteoric craters studded the landscape and made it appear as battered as the moon. There were areas that looked as if the ground were underlaid by layers of permafrost, oceans of water frozen underground. There were cliffs and highlands that undoubtedly bore the testimony of billions of years of weathering, and the huge Hellas Basin, a hole nearly 1,000 miles wide and 3 miles deep. The physicists wanted to study how energetic radiation and subatomic particles streaming in from the sun and stars interacted with the thin Martian atmosphere. They also wanted to probe the planet's interior to determine why Mars had no planet-wide magnetic field, as Earth does. The Russians especially wanted to examine the two tiny moons of Mars and test techniques for extracting rocket propellants from their rocky bodies. The Americans wanted to visit the old Viking 1 lander and place a plaque on it honoring a dead scientist. The resolution of these conflicting desires was a compromise that pleased no one. The landing site picked was just north of the equator at 100 degrees west latitude, on the edge of the massive upland rise called the Tharsis Bulge. To the south was the badlands of Noctis Labyrinthus. To the west, the mammoth Tharsis Shield volcanoes. But their actual landing site was an undistinguished, gently sloping flatland that was considered relatively safe for the landings, about equally distant from the western end of the monumental rift valley known as Valles Marineris and the chain of volcanoes that crown the Tharsis Highlands. A special team in the orbiting spacecraft would visit Deimos and Phobos, the two moons of Mars, so that the Russians could test their ideas. One of the American astronauts could fly the SOAR plane to the Viking 1 site, if conditions permitted. The ground team commander, cosmonaut Mikhail Andreevich Voznesensky, would decide if the conditions were right, and the flight would take place only if the expedition commander, Dr. Li Chengdu, granted his approval. The explorers had two sizable ground vehicles for cross-country travel and two gossamer-winged SOAR planes for covering longer distances. Mission plans were specific and detailed. There would be brief excursions to the Noctis Labyrinthus Badlands and to one of the Tharsis volcanoes. There would be extensive chemical tests of the Martian soil. There would be drilling to look for underground water. And, of course, there would be the ongoing search for any sign that life might have once existed on Mars. Of all the landing sites in all the regions of all the planet Mars, they had to pick this, Jamie grumbled to himself, probably the dullest place they could find. A moderately cratered plain on an upland bulge, too far from the interesting line of volcanoes to even glimpse their 16-mile-high peaks above the horizon. Some sand dunes off to the west and the same old rocks that lay all across the surface everywhere you looked. The most interesting thing in this region would be the fracture ridges in the wild badlands to the south, but that's nearly 300 kilometers away. Ah, well, he sighed inwardly. They picked this spot for a safe landing, not for its geological interest. Get to work. Jamie began by collecting rock samples. The broad, open plain on which they had landed was covered with rocks ranging from pebble-sized to boulders as big as a man, probably thrown up when a good-sized meteoroid hit the ground, or maybe an eruption of one of the Tharsis volcanoes, although they didn't look as if they had erupted so violently. Jamie's equipment back in the dome would tell him which it was, he felt sure.
"Please be sure to look for any odd color,"
Joanna's voice came to him through his earphones. Jamie turned his head and saw only the inside of his helmet. He turned his entire body 90 degrees, and there she was in her day-glow suit a dozen meters away, with Monique Bonnet still close beside her.
"Any color in particular?"
he half-joked.
"We've got a great assortment of reds and pinks here." "Green would be nice,"
chirped Monique's lightly pleasant voice.
"Any color at all that seems out of the ordinary,"
Joanna said.
"We are not particular. Not yet."
Just outside the dome's airlock, Connors was setting up one of the TV cameras for his educational show. He had a little box of props at his feet. The others were stooped over as far as the suits would allow, intently searching the sandy soil like a squad of groundkeepers looking for litter. Or that famous painting, Jamie said to himself, "The Gleaners." That's what we're doing, gleaning, trying to find scraps of food for our minds in this frozen desert. "Damn tough to see the ground inside the suit," Jamie grumbled silently. "Hardly any flexibility at all. Whoever designed these aluminum cans wasn't thinking about the work we have to do while we're inside them." Toshima was busily setting up a weather station about 20 meters from the dome, on the side away from the two landing vehicles. His peach-colored suit blended with the rust-red background much better than Jamie would have thought. "He's camouflaged. That could be a problem. The suit colors had been picked to stand out clearly against the Martian landscape. Who the hell okayed peach?" Ilona was scooping up the loose sandy soil with a small shovel and pouring it into a box. She, Joanna, and Monique were going to try to raise an assortment of beans, squash, peas, and cucumbers inside the dome, using as much of the native Martian resources as possible, including water, if they found any. One of the goals of their research was to see how the lighter Martian gravity would affect plant growth and size. They expected to bring their small agricultural test facility back to the orbiting spacecraft with them and continue the experiment on the return flight to Earth. "They'll have to bake the oxides out of the soil first," Jamie knew. "Otherwise, it'll be like planting seeds in bleach." He turned his attention to the rocks. There was certainly no shortage of them. Big blocks more than a meter wide. Plenty of smaller stuff down to the size of pebbles. Many of the rocks looked pitted, etched by weathering. Couldn't be rain, Jamie thought. Hasn't rained here in a billion years, I'd bet. There was frost on winter mornings, though. The rocks expanded in the day's heat, such as it was, and contracted during the bitterly cold nights. But that wouldn't pit them, Jamie thought. They ought to crack laterally and flake, not get pitted like golf balls. If they were volcanic, then the pitting could be from gases trapped inside the rocks, bubbling out and escaping. Could they have been thrown all the way out here from the volcanoes, 600 or 700 kilometers away? Or had they been blasted out of the ground by ancient meteor strikes and thrown clear of the atmosphere, re-entering afterward like ballistic missiles? He filled the two sacks he had brought with him with rocks of varying sizes, then realized with a start that he had been out for more than 3 hours. The sun was almost directly overhead, a strangely tiny and pale imitation of the sun he had known, shining weakly out of the salmon-colored sky. Turning, he could no longer see the dome, although the blunt cylindrical tops of the two landers were still visible. In the distance, he saw one of the unmanned spacecraft, its big cargo hatch gaping open, empty. "The horizon is shorter here," he reminded himself. "Turn around. Get yourself oriented properly."
"Waterman, you are out of range of the monitor cameras."
Vosnesensky's voice sounded more annoyed than worried.
"Can you hear me?" "Yes, loud and clear. You are almost at the limit of safe walk-back distance. Come back toward the dome."
Jamie felt almost glad that he was being commanded to come back. It was one thing to be alone back home, in the mountains or desert scrubland. Out here, in this strange world, without air to breathe or water to drink, Jamie had been almost frightened. And yet, it felt good to be alone, away from the others. Solitude had been rare, non-existent, over the past several years. Jamie stood as tall as his suit would allow and gazed out toward the beckoning horizon, his back to the dome and the others. Even inside the hard shell of his suit, he strove to get a feeling for this Martian landscape, a sense of harmony with this strange new world. Then he saw a patch of green. TV script. During initial excursion on Sol 3, pilot astronaut P. Connors will demonstrate on camera the following. 1. Colors of Martian landscape. Pan camera to show ground color and color of sky. 2. A Martian rock. Pick up moderate-sized rock, show it to camera. Explain that red color is from oxidation of iron-based minerals. 3. Temperature. Place thermometer on ground. Show temperature, approximately 60 to 70 degrees Fahrenheit. Lift thermometer to eye level. Show mercury dropping to zero or below. Explain that this phenomenon is due to low heat retention capacity of thin Martian atmosphere. 4. Low air pressure. Open flask of ordinary water and let camera see that it immediately boils, even at temperature of zero or below, because of extremely low air pressure. Explain that same would happen to blood in body if not protected by pressurized hard suit. 5. Low gravity. Drop rock hammer to show that it falls more slowly than similar object on Earth, although faster than on Moon. Contrast with earlier videotape of astronaut Connors dropping same rock hammer when on Moon. 6. Moon of Mars. If visible against daylight sky, show inner moon, Phobos, as it rises in west and crosses Martian sky in 4 hours. It is not necessary to show entire 4-hour transit. Use telescopic lens to show Phobos changing phase from new to quarter to full. Tape can be edited to fit time allowed for broadcast.